Ave.
And welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode XCIII, Powerful Personalities. As the Senate clawed more power from the people, it was inevitable that a few would rise above others and take over command and influence with an army. Marius, Sulla, and the civil war that followed would just be another log on the funeral pyre of the Roman Republic. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Gaius Marius is a really important military figure and politician who stretches from the very end of the 2nd century BCE into the 1st century BCE. He's probably the most important politician of the time. And he's an astounding figure because he kind of comes from nowhere. He's born in central Italy in a place called Arpinum, which is not where famous Romans generally come from. It's a sort of a bit of a nowhere place, although incidentally where Cicero will come from too. And he is...
Those are awkward statues to have next to each other.
Yeah, but like Cicero, he is a new man. He's a man who hasn't... No one in his family has had a consular career. So it doesn't look good for him in the Roman Republican system where the magistracies are sort of shared within a few elite families. Nevertheless, he works his way through and he gets propelled by having the right kind of sponsors to have the most spectacular career and the most consulships that anyone has ever had until this point.
So why are we talking about Marius when our wider series, our wider mini-series within a series, is about the fall of the Roman Republic? What does he have to do with this gradual falling process?
He's somebody who some people would say brings it on, because if you want to fit him into that pattern of optimates and populares, so the senatorial supporters and the supporters of the people, he's very much on the side of the populares, the people. And he is one of the people responsible for a civil war that happens in the early 1st century BCE. But perhaps most importantly of all, he brings about changes in the army. Perhaps no one could have foreseen it, but they do lead to the potential for the Republic to fall, because generals can now, in the end, pretty much have personal armies.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a decades-long process, but he's the one that brings the first change about.
Okay, so he's setting up a couple more pieces of the puzzle that's just going to make it all go to crap.
So that is the technical term.
So I hear. So how does he rise to power then? He's not from the right family. It sounds like he's got the right military clout though, or he gets it.
Yeah, and it's pretty gradual. He has a military career that stretches right back to 133 BCE, where he is a commander, kind of sub-commander with Scipio Aemilianus, who is a famous, from a famous political and military family. And he sort of works his way through the ranks, and he gets sponsored in particular by a man called Metellus, who he end up having very much a love-hate relationship with. He also kind of enhances his own career by marrying into the family of Julius Caesar. He marries Caesar's aunt, Julia, which is a really clever thing to do because they can see he's on the way up. They're from a really highly aristocratic patrician family. Mm-hmm. Their fortunes are kind of on the way down, so they can sort of help each other. So this really helps him to fit in with the Roman elites, the Roman aristocracy, by having this connection with the Julians.
What was the really big military victory then that he became associated with, that he had under his belt?
He works himself up to the position of being a commander in the war against Jugurtha, which is a complicated conflict that the Romans get involved in. Basically, they are sticking their oar into a conflict within a kingdom in North Africa, where there are warring brothers or adopted brothers who kind of appeal to Rome to ask, you know, which of them should be on the throne. Their kingdom is divided, and Jugurtha, the one who gets the lesser half, decides he's not happy with this, and so he restarts a conflict. And the Romans, in the end, do send troops in. And in fact, the commander who's sent in is Marius's sponsor, Metellus, and Marius goes with him. But that's the point where Marius starts to kind of work against Metellus. They come into personal conflict. Marius wants to go back to Rome to stand for consul. He wants to do that in 105. And Metellus says, he says to him, this is really quite insulting, no, 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 I want you to be consul, but I want you to stand for the consulship along with my son. And his son at the time is 21. Now, the minimum age for consulship
like 42.
Is 42. You're yeah. quite right. Yeah. So that means wait another 21 years.
Oh, okay. I get what you mean.
And Marius just refuses. So as well as getting to be the consul of 104, as we'll see, he ends up winning the people over. So the moment when things go badly for the Romans at various times during this war, they end up appointing him instead of reappointing Metellus. This is another important point in the, I don't want to say it's the decline of the Roman Republic, but certainly the decline of the Roman Senate and the elite power, is that the people say, we want Marius.
Right.
So they're kind of against the wishes of the Senate, who want to reappoint Metellus. So that's an important event that happens back in Rome. Again, it's conflict between the Senate and the people. So he gets to finish the war against Jugurtha and get the glory from that. Jugurtha's actually betrayed in the end by his own people. Nevertheless, Marius will get the triumph for it in 104, which is also when he's consul for the first time.
Right. So as a result, you've got somebody who's essentially a hero of a war and is now the consul.
Yeah, the army is on his side. The people is on his side.
Yeah.
Certainly with hindsight, you can see him as the first warlord of Rome, the first one who kind of has this base of support that comes from the military and the ordinary people.
So one of the benefits of having your military leader, if you're a soldier, become the consul and be a hero is that they can look out for your best interests. So he starts putting in reforms at this point to help out the army, to change the army, to build it up. So why is he doing this and what does he do?
Well, I'm not sure that all the army would have regarded this necessarily as helping them, but certainly it will ensure Roman victories. And that is, he changes the composition of the Roman army. They were previously composed of people from a certain level of property in Rome. He opens it up so that basically there's a whole lot more people for the Romans to choose their army from. So the soldiers can come from those without property. And really, this is about social change, because when the rules were laid down for, you know, the Roman army must only be men from one of the first five property classes, they actually had them in grades. This was at a time when the Romans were fighting fairly local battles within Italy. And the soldiers could be people who worked on their land. They went and fought battles, and then they came back to work the land again. So they were soldier farmers, which remains a Roman ideal for centuries.
It's a really terrible idea.
Well, I guess it worked for the early Romans when they didn't have a professional army. But now they're fighting much further afield. They are fighting conflicts that might go on for, you know, season after season after season, year after year after year.
Mm.
And they're people who might not get back to their farm.
Mm.
Also, remember, in the absence of some of these people, but happening anyway, the Roman elites have been buying up lots of land to consolidate it and make these huge estates that were called latifundia. So there's a shortage of land anyway. So that means you've got more and more landless people, some of whom have no means of making a living.
Yeah.
And there's a need for a bigger army now that Rome is starting to control a larger area of empire.
All right. So they relax the entry requirements. And also that way you get the entry of the career soldier at that point, I suppose.
Yeah, it does have that effect. The Roman elites are very sniffy about it. They talk about it as enrolling the mob.
Mm.
Those who are just the people we count in the census.
The unwashed masses.
They call them the head count.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it does mean that you have a much larger supply. It means that you have to professionalize your army. There are people who are going to be soldiers full time, or certainly for, you know, a large number of years rather than part time. They're going to be paid for their services much more regularly, and that you need to make sure that that's done in a professional manner. So this is the beginning of a professional Roman army. It might seem very late in the day, considering how long Romans have been fighting other peoples and building an empire. But really, this is the beginning of it.
You end up getting soldiers, I suppose, who have a lot more experience, so you have a stronger army. But you also would get soldiers that become very loyal to their general, not necessarily to their state because they're not landholders. They've got no stake in that. They've got no stake in the empire per se, but to their general.
Yep.
So was this Marius's intention, or is this just a happy coincidence for him?
I think it's very hard to say whether it was Marius's intention. I don't know if he had that much foresight.
He definitely made the most of it, though.
Yeah, and look, it does have that result that their soldiers rely on him even after the end of their service. So what we get the beginning of, and we see particularly through the first century BCE, it happens with Marius and then it will happen with Pompey and Caesar as well. When the war is over, or when the soldiers have finished their term of service of, you know, maybe 16 years or so, their commander, who will be a politician as well, will work to find land for his veterans. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of reward at the end of it. You see this as a kind of retirement plan almost, but you'll still owe it to the commander. So this is what Marius will work to do with his veterans. And of course, there's a kind of cycle of it, because the more land you conquer, throw off the people who live there, perhaps, you have land for your veterans there and you start colonies. And this ensures that Roman power is forced out further. There's a sort of cycle of conquest and keeping the army happy, then also empowering the commanders.
And at that point as well, I suppose you've got the opportunity, or at least the threat, that at any point, if you're the general, you'll be able to click your fingers and your veterans will come to you.
Yeah, you're quite right that the first century BCE does see not just the veterans, but even while you're enrolled in the army, the loyalty is to the individual commander. And that's very dangerous from the Roman point of view, because the state should come first. But this has the result that you can now have civil wars. This is when the civil wars, the whole series of civil wars that will tear Italy apart in the first century BCE, really stems from this. Because if the soldiers were loyal to Rome, who's going to fight each other?
Yeah.
But now that you're loyal to a commander, you'll fight for him, and there's a whole other group of soldiers who will fight for a different commander. So you kind of enable the circumstances for civil war to flourish, unfortunately.
So it ended up being a good thing that Marius bolstered up the army a bit, I suppose, because he would need it very soon.
Yes, the Romans need an army that's very much prepared, because even while the Jugurthine War was rolling up, there are all kinds of murmurings from the north where the Gallic Germanic tribes are moving west and south. It starts off with two groups called the Cimbri and the Teutones, and then another group gets involved called the Tigrinnes. They're kind of heading for North Italy through a complicated series of movements. This is something that is going to end up with Caesar fighting the Gallic Wars, but that's decades down the road. These are migrations that are going on, and the Romans start to see it as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So they've already got a province in what is now southern France, Provence. And of course, they've got interests kind of across the Alps and northern Italy, in a place they at that time called Gaul as well. So this is a reason why they kind of want to finish off the North African War, because they've got trouble at the other end brewing. And Marius is ready to deal with this. And he will get to be consul quite a few times more because of this. So he's consul in 104. As we've said, the rules are that he's not meant to be consul again for another 10 years. But in fact, he's consul 5 times in a row after this.
Yeah, that's a big change to how the Roman Senate has worked before. So why does this happen now?
Well, it's the Roman Constitution that's threatened by this. Well, in a time of threat, it is legitimate to put aside some of these laws, but technically what you should do is appoint a dictator.
I was about to say, that's dictator though.
Yeah, and that's very short-lived. Marius manages to just basically threaten the Senate into accepting this. It's the first really extra-constitutional thing that happens, to a large degree anyway. And it happens perpetually. And really, again, it's the voice of the people clashing with the Senate and winning. In this case, both the threat that's coming from the northern peoples and the will of the people, the Roman people, mean that Marius gets more power than anyone's ever had, which is quite surprising for someone who's come from nowhere in terms of where his family standing is. We might want to note with this as well that the first time Marius gets to be consul in 104, he didn't even go back to Rome to stand. Remember, Metellus wasn't keen on him leaving. You're meant to go back and be in Rome to put up your candidature. But he gets elected in absentia, which is also against the constitution. He's breaking rules left, right, and center, and he's allowed to do that. Nevertheless, as we move into the first century, despite all of this success and the triumphs and the perpetual consulships, Marius does end up getting sort of left a little bit on the outer, and there are new figures rising, especially a man called Sulla. And by the time we get to the end of the 90s and the next big conflict, Marius won't be heavily involved in that. He doesn't die until 86, but he doesn't get to be heavily involved in Roman politics, it seems, through the 90s.
So this is the start of what's called the social war, really, which, as I vaguely understand it, is all about who gets to be a Roman citizen. So what is the status quo there? Why was there the desire to change? Why did it lead to war?
There are various grades of Roman citizenship. So there's full citizenship for those who are in Rome and are freeborn. Mm. And then even if you're just outside of Rome in the areas that speak Latin.
So not even an hour on the train.
No,
you wouldn't be Roman there.
You'd be on the local train for this.
Yeah.
They're Latins and they get a kind of second grade, second tier of citizenship called Latin citizenship. And then outside of that, they're allies. They're not citizens at all. The Latin word for ally is a socius.
Mm.
That's how we get social war. They will end up having a war with the allies. The Romans had a sort of understanding, a deal with them, but it wasn't one that incorporated citizenship. And basically what was happening with the Italians is that they were having magistrates imposed on them from Rome who could exploit them, who could oppress them. So they wanted citizenship so that they could be on an equal footing with the citizens in Rome. Because there's been a debate about this. Why do they want citizenship when what it means is you can go and vote? Are they likely to have trudged all the way to Rome to vote? They didn't have postal votes. Mm. They couldn't vote in absentia. And it's thought that it wasn't so much being able to vote for magistrates as the having rights to stand up against magistrates when they were corrupt. They wanted this equal footing, and the Romans were very conservative and stubborn about it and said no. And in the end, the allies decided they'd had enough. Because there were certain Romans who had tried to ameliorate this. If you remember when we talked about the Gracchi, they had tried to incorporate a series of policies, especially Gaius Gracchus had tried to enroll the Italians. As we saw, he entirely failed and got murdered. And this was happening again in the late 90s BCE. It's always a tribune of the plebs, isn't it? A tribune of the plebs called Livius Drusus, who ironically is the son of someone who'd been an enemy of the Gracchi. He tries to bring forward a citizenship bill, and he was murdered by an unknown assassin, but probably someone sent by the Senate. Mm-hmm. So their good old policy of let's just wipe out anyone who tries to change the citizenship of Rome.
Yeah. So it's actually the allies who end up taking the role upon themselves to contest this. Is it even considered a civil war, though? It wouldn't even be a civil war.
It doesn't get called a civil war because they're not Romans at this point. They kind of establish a rival state. One of their major towns in central Italy called Corfinum, they rename it Italia. And they start to...
Oh, they establish their own senate, don't they?
Yeah, they get their own magistrates. They're kind of mirroring, it's thought, mirroring the Roman system. The bit I like best is that they release their own coinage, including a coin. One of my favorites is showing their representative, their kind of symbol is the Italian bull.
Yes.
And the bull is goring a wolf, the Roman wolf. So this is a kind of threat.
Yeah.
This is what we'll do to you, Rome. It's a very strange kind of war, though, because, I mean, like all wars, it's antagonistic. But it's a war because they want the Romans. Mm. They want the Romans to give them what they have and not just to steal it from them, but to extend it to the allies.
So, and here's the thing that I can never seem to get my head around. The Italians lose.
Yes.
But they win.
But they win.
They get everything that they wanted.
Yeah. That does sometimes happen in wars, isn't it? When I was growing up, it's what British people thought about the Second World War. The Germans lost, but their economy was so much stronger than ours, at least the West Germans. Exactly. It's a very complicated and messy war. The war is sort of said to last 91 to 88. But even during the war, the Romans are starting to kind of give way to the Italians and bring in policies that basically enroll them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they keep the war short. Because the Italians, in the end, they sort of give in because they've sort of got what they want anyway.
Yeah, sure.
They do it in a series of laws, series of policies. But by 88, all of the Italians, freeborn Italians, have Roman citizenship.
Okay. And at this point in this war as well, you have the rise of Sulla.
Yes.
All right, Sulla.
Lucius Cornelius Sulla, unlike Marius, from an extremely elite family, the Cornelii. They've long been an honored Roman family. This isn't his very first appearance. He has been involved in Africa too, but he is much more prominent in the social war, where Marius doesn't really seem to make much of an appearance. He doesn't get an appointment. They will come into conflict again through another foreign war. This is this time out in the east against Mithridates of Pontus. Now, we won't go into too much detail about Mithridates and that war, but Mithridates VI, as he is, kind of takes the opportunity of this social war to seize land in Rome's new Eastern Empire.
Oh, so he makes the most of Rome being distracted by their own, I'm going to say internal, but their own problems.
Yeah, exactly. And look, some of the Greeks see him as a liberator. So after all, the Romans aren't necessarily their friends. Marius and Sulla are both consuls in 88, the final year of the social war. At this point, you know, a consul will often lead an army into battle, and they both want to do that against Mithridates.
Okay.
And the Senate gives the role to Sulla. Sulla will end up being very much the Senate's friend, so this is perhaps not surprising. But Marius gets one of his mates, a tribune, again, tribune of the people, mm-hmm. often opponents of the Senate, a man called Sulpicius, to veto that and to appoint Marius instead. So we've kind of got instantly conflict between the two of them there. And it's a conflict yet again has kind of phrased itself as the Senate against the tribune of the people.
Yeah,
Senate
sure.
Against the people, basically.
Yeah. And you've got the Senate with their nose out of joint because their decision's been overruled to send Sulla over east. And then you've got Marius clearing his throat going, oh, look at all these soldiers and veterans who are loyal to me.
Yeah.
It'd be nasty if somebody, I don't know, maybe left the handbrake off and see what happens.
Yeah, well, Sulla's the first one to move on this. And he basically starts the civil war by bringing his army to Rome.
Yeah, okay.
Marius flees at this point.
Oh, so Sulla goes, oh, look at all these men from the social war who are all loyal to me and suddenly have been settled in all these nice places around Campania.
Mm. Marius is kind of on the outer here, and his man on the inside, Sulpicius, is killed and his head sent to Sulla in a lovely little detail there. And then put in the forum, and they kind of go through the rigmarole of annulling Sulpicius's laws. So it's like stripping back history. Let's get back to what we want.
And Marius is an enemy of the state.
Yes.
And in Africa.
Yeah. At this point, we have civil war. And Marius and Sulla start a pattern which will really haunt Rome through the first century of what are called proscriptions. These are lists of people that they say are enemies of the state. And this means anyone can kill them.
Yes.
And get some of their property, and the rest of it goes to the state with impunity.
So Sulla's got the Senate on his side at that point, so I can understand him having a list. But Marius comes up with his own list, which essentially has Sulla and the Senate on it.
Yeah, and some senators were murdered. There are widely differing estimates about how many people were murdered in these proscriptions. They range from 1,600 equestrians and 40 senators to an admittedly a much later historian, a medieval historian, who says there were 9,000 people killed during these proscriptions. It was extremely bloody. I mean, 1,600 is still a huge number. Must have been a time of terrible fear and doubt. If somebody who didn't like you would just put your name on the list, then you're up for grabs. Or somebody who wants your property, indeed.
I'd also be thinking, what happened to our Senate? It was going so well. Kind of.
it kind of wasn't, because the Senate is increasingly coming into conflict with the people.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that that's the way that the First Civil War kind of ranges itself. And remember, while this is going on, these proscriptions, that's kind of how the war is fought, because we've got another war going on with Mithridates, and this time Sulla, because Marius has fled, gets to lead the army out to defeat Mithridates. Marius moves back from Africa and he can start his proscriptions back in Rome.
Sulla leaves it unattended.
Yeah, I mean, Marius kills the consul and has his head put in the forum, presumably as retribution after the same thing had happened to Sulpicius. So Marius has now got control of the Senate and declares that Sulla is in exile.
Mm.
It's really messy. Plutarch, the biographer who wrote both A Life of Marius and A Life of Sulla, he says at Marius, chapter 43, so many were slain that at last Cinna's appetite for murder was dulled and sated. But Marius, whose anger increased day by day and thirsted for blood, kept on killing all whom he held in any suspicion whatever.
Sounds like he's very much taking it personally.
Yeah, I always feel like I'm quite fond of Marius, but reading something like that makes it quite difficult, actually. and it doesn't really resolve itself. Often people talk about the later conflict between Pompey and Caesar as a civil war. This is not so much a war as a spate of murders, first by Sulla, then by Marius back in Rome. Partly it doesn't resolve itself because Marius just dies. He dies in 86, not right. really as part of any war or conflict, but his death allows Sulla to come back into the picture and sort of to win.
Mm.
So Marius is consul when he dies for the seventh time.
For 17 days.
Yeah, it's a pretty short consulship.
Yeah.
But as I say, his death means that Sulla can return. He's had a victory out east with Mithridates. The civil war sort of continues because Marius's son continues this war against Sulla, but Sulla wins.
Yeah. At that point, I suppose he cleans up shop, but he doesn't let control back to the Senate, really, does he?
No. He basically declares a state of emergency and he does
Sulla,
that.
Sulla, the friend of the Senate, keeps control of it.
Look, he does it in various ways. A part of the conflict that's been going on that we haven't really mentioned since the Gracchi is who has control of the extortion courts. Might seem like a trivial thing, but remember, the Gracchi tried to transfer that partly to the equestrians so that it wouldn't be the Senate judging itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your mates saying, you're all right, really, I'll let you off.
Yeah.
Sulla makes sure that that goes back to the Senate. So he gives much more control back to the Senate. They're happy with that. He increases the size of the Senate, so they have more power. But when he gets back, when he has victory over the Marians in the civil war, he makes himself dictator. He doesn't want to let anybody have any room for maneuver. As I say, he basically declares a state of emergency by doing that because this is a crisis position. We've mentioned before that it's one that's only meant to come into being for 6 months at the most, and it's meant to sort of tide you over while Rome is in a state of emergency.
I was under the impression, though, that it meant external threats, state of emergency.
Yeah, it's certainly created for that.
Yeah.
And it hadn't been used for a very long time. And Sulla, he doesn't give it up after 6 months. He remains as dictator for 3 years. So this is starting to look worrying. I think we know of similar developments in various parts of the world now where somebody increases the term. They're not meant to have more than a certain term and they make it for life or they make it longer than it should be.
Well, like this, when there's changes to the constitution that weren't originally intended.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You want to keep on with your state of control.
Mm.
And being dictator gives you a lot of power, as the term implies, that you don't have to have a trial before somebody is executed. You don't have to go through the Senate to distribute land. You know, you don't have to have new laws. You can decide who gets citizenship. It really is absolute power. I mean, obviously the consuls have an awful lot of power, but they get voted in every year and laws have to go through the People's Assembly and the Senate. And there's the veto of the Tribune of the People, which Sulla gets rid of.
Does he keep the consuls intact the way they were, though? Because they would, in practice, have no power, I suppose, if there's a dictator there.
Well, they still have the right to veto.
Yeah.
But because he has the Senate basically on his side and he's increased it from 300 to 600, he's kind of got his mates in place. He doesn't really have to fear the consuls. And I'm sure that they live in fear of him anyway with all of this power. He has stripped the rights of the Council of the People, who had done things like voting Marius into the consulship repeatedly, giving him the power to go and fight wars. And he brings back the law of no repeat consulships. So he is actually exerting some power over the consulship there. And this is really a way of getting back at Marius, to dig at him for doing that.
Mm.
It's a bit late. Marius is dead, but it's saying what he did is wrong. Sulla does all of these things that all of them really fit within this remit of a very conservative, senatorial-based control. However, even the Senate must have been worried that he was keeping control of the dictatorship, this position, for longer than he should.
Mm.
And in fact, very mysteriously, the Romans themselves were puzzled by this. In 79 BCE, Sulla just gave up being dictator.
Yeah.
He didn't say, I'm going to be consul this year or exert any power. He just retired.
Okay.
It was like absolute power to nothing.
Left Rome retired?
Yeah. Yeah. He went off into retirement, died the following year, peacefully in his bed. The one who perhaps least deserved it of all those who die peacefully in their beds. Way into the imperial period, one of the standard debates that they might give to a schoolboy is, imagine you're advising Sulla on whether to retire or not. Because they couldn't understand why he did it, why he gave up all of this power.
He must have known that he was sick.
Maybe
there,
so,
there must have been something going on there. So, on balance, would the Senate have preferred Marius to stick around rather than Sulla? And on balance, who do you think the Roman Republic would have been better off with?
It's really, really hard. The Senate obviously does well out of Sulla. You know, he just gets rid of the people that he doesn't want in the Senate. So the people who are left are Sullan supporters, you can bet. Personally, I feel more drawn to Marius because he's a popularis. But to be honest, they're both mass murderers.
And they're both bad for the Republic.
Yeah, they are both bad for the Republic because they're divisive figures. Whichever of them wins, the other side feels aggrieved. And this is not over. When Sulla dies peacefully in his bed, it's not over. He's given so much power to the Senate that there is going to be a move to remove that. And that's why we'll get more civil wars.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Reviews are appreciated. They help other people find the podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for the podcast, so until the next episode, I am Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening.